Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, October 25, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call on 11th hour changes to the census, newly proposed racial categorizations. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we welcome our experts, Mike Gonzalez, Senior Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and we also have with us Roger Clegg, President and General Counsel at the Center for Equal Opportunity. Today, I will turn it over to Mike Gonzalez to get us started. Following opening remarks, we will open the floor for questions. Thank you for speaking with us. Mike, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks, Nate, and thanks, Roger, and thanks all of you who are listening in. What I'll do is I'll speak with just under 10 minutes. I'll give you I'll tell you what has happened and give you my analysis of it. On September 30th, the Office of Management and Budget proposed a new rule on the nation's racial categories, and the rule was titled Standards for Maintaining, Collecting, Presenting Federal Data on Race and Ethnicity. Now, OMB called this a limited revision that is needed to improve data collection and better serve a more diverse country. I believe the data will be collected for political reasons and to perpetuate the multicultural vision of America. Now, two proposed changes stand out. The first one has grabbed the most attention is the creation of a new minority group for people whose ancestors or themselves have come from the Middle East and North Africa to be called MENA. The second is less well understood, but I believe is the more important one, and what it does is it effectively eliminates the choice that Hispanics now have to choose their race. Now, for MENA, for those of you who have visions of foreign-looking immigrants, Arab Americans actually include such household names as Casey Kasem and Ralph Nader and Doug Flutie and Helen Thomas. Now, whatever you think of these people, they're not generally thought of as minorities. Arab Americans are mostly Christian, and especially those from Lebanon and Syria, who began to come into the country in the 1890s through Ellis Island. Now, Iranian Americans, for their part, are mostly secular professionals who immigrated here after the fall of the Shah and have very high per capita average incomes. Now, obviously, I'm generalizing a bit here, but I think the generalities do work. All these people are currently identified as white in the census, but as members of the vulnerable minority group MENA, they would become, quote-unquote, a people of color, with the implications that everyone on this call understands for congressional redistricting, which is really important to what is being done here, and the whole panoply of affirmative action programs that we have all come to love and to know and love. Now let's turn to the second proposal that stands out, and that is the converging the questions, the two questions that are asked now of everyone, of all 330 million Americans, one on ethnicity, whether you're Hispanic or not, and the other one on race. This proposal is very vague, and to understand it, you have to dig deeply into the links and the footnotes of the OMB notice. What it effectively does, I believe, is make Hispanic the only racial identifier for the 56 million people who are told to identify themselves as Hispanics. Now, this, I believe, is the holy grail of liberal demographics mongering. President Clinton already tried to do this in the mid-1990s when he tried, to add Hispanics as a racial designation rather than an ethnicity, unquote. He failed, and I think what we're seeing here is a second bite of the apple. One reason that they might have acted is that more than half of Hispanics, in fact, there were 29 million, ticked white in the 2010 census. And that was a very big jump of 11 million over the census of 2000, when some 18 million Hispanics also ticked the white box. And something else happened along the same lines. 1 million people who had ticked both Hispanic and white in 2000 did not tick Hispanic at all in 2010, and they went from Hispanic to non-Hispanic white. And so all of that began to raise some eyebrows. Many people commented, have been commenting on this, One of them was Michael Lind in Politico. Now, he noted that Hispanics accounted for 3/4 of the white population growth in the 21st century. And he wrote in May, quote, "If increasing numbers of Hispanics identify as white and their descendants are defined as white in government statistics, there may be a white majority in the U.S. throughout the 21st century," unquote. Matthew Iglesias, who's a very recognizable voice on the left, wrote on Vox, and Vox is not a conservative publication. He wrote that this sort of thing has, quote, "implications for projections about America becoming majority-minority and other such matters. Racial and ethnic identities are plastic and subject to change," unquote. Now, the proposed change, I think, will make things less plastic. And if you're Rui Teixeira or John Judas or John Podesta sitting in your office envisioning a majority-minority country that will give you winning liberal coalitions as far as the eye can see in the 21st century, what has happened in the census is bound to give you heartburn. Now, let me explain a little bit what these racial classifications are, because the self-identification as white has for well over a century now been a proxy, a signal that an immigrant group sees itself as joining the mainstream, which is a step toward wanting to preserve the culture of America, the traditions of America, rather than trying to overturn it, which has been what the liberals have tried to do for the last 30 years. Further historical background on this, and then I'll shut up. Mexican Americans were officially classified as white after America inherited about 100,000 Mexican Americans who chose to stay in the Southwest territories after the 1848 Mexican War, the end of it. I guess California became a state right away, and Texas became a state also, but a lot of them were territories, and about 150,000 people were estimated to have been there. They were classified as whites. Now, in the 1960s, academics and community organizers and the leaders of activist organizations, in other words, the people who benefit from the division of the country into groups, they began to work real hard to convince rank-and-file Mexican Americans that they were members of a minority group, that they were vulnerable and victims of systematic discrimination. Now, the evidence is that that the rank and file really fought back against this. I encourage you to read the writings of Leo Grebler, the UCLA academic who was paid by the Ford Foundation to canvass Mexican Americans in the Southwest in the 1960s, and he wrote bitterly about what he encountered. At one point, he complained in amazement about people who have experienced discrimination but, quote, "failed to generalize their resentment about it," unquote. So in other words, what Grebler is complaining is that these people don't see themselves as victims of systemic discrimination. And what the left set out to do for the past five decades is to make sure that victimhood sinks in and is felt. And I believe that this move by OMB is a further step in the process. To conclude, folks, I think this is really, really important, and the administration knows it is important. Let's not forget that one of President Obama's first acts in office was to give the White House direct oversight of the director of the U.S. Census Bureau. White House spokesman Ben Lebolt said at the time that, quote, "from the first days of the transition, the census has been a priority for President Obama," unquote. Now, the move was denounced at the time as a way to politicize the census. Congressman Daryl Issa led the charge, and ironically, he's a Syrian-American who would be affected by these proposals. He complained at the time that, quote, "requiring the census director to report directly to the White House chief of staff is a shameful, transparent attempt by the administration to politicize the census and manipulate the census," unquote. So I guess what I want to leave you with is that we conservatives bellyache all the time about things we can do nothing about the 1965 immigration law and any other such things, but completely ignore the demographic games that the other side is playing right under our nose. And if I would urge the callers to look more deeply into this. And I guess that's it. I hand it over to Roger. Roger?
Mike, thank you very, very much for not only your presentation today and participating, but for the work that you're doing at the Heritage Foundation on these race and ethnicity and assimilation issues. It is enormously important. And I also want to thank the Federalist Society for putting together this teleforum so quickly. As you noted at the outset, the administration is really moving very quickly on this. They've allowed only 30 days for comment, and in fact, that window closes in a week. In fact, a week from yesterday, October 31st, at midnight on Halloween, appropriately enough, is the end of the period for comment. So if anyone is interested in commenting, and I hope people are, you know, the clock is ticking. I'm just going to give a little bit of context for this this latest initiative by the Obama administration, and it is it's a very disturbing context. I think if anything, Mike understates what the administration is up to. This is an administration that has never met a racial categorization that it doesn't like. At the same, and it's I think really trying to ramp up its use of such classifications as the administration comes to an end. For example, in the last month, despite a distinct lack of interest from Congress in doing anything along these lines, the administration has pushed ahead with its efforts to recognize Native Hawaiians as an Indian tribe, creating yet another another step toward additional balkanization of our country. And of course, it's always supporting racial and ethnic preferences of all kinds, whether it's in university admissions or government contracting or employment or whatever. It's very aggressive in its use of the disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement. It's encouraged the racial grievance hustlers in the inner cities during the Black Lives Matter protests. And this is something that the left likes, not just for its own sake, that is, these divisive racial politics, but also because it advances other parts of its agenda. In the notice that OMB published, it has a series of bullet points on federal uses of race and ethnicity data, and it reminds me of, I think, one of Justice Scalia's dissents, where he begins by saying, sometimes this court is confronted by a wolf in sheep's clothing, but this wolf comes as a wolf. OMB doesn't make a lot of make a big secret about what it has in mind here. I mean, here are some of the things that it says this data is going to be useful for: enforcing the requirements of the Voting Rights Act, reviewing state congressional redistricting plans, establishing and evaluating federal affirmative action plans, and evaluating affirmative action and discrimination in employment in the private sector, monitoring and enforcing desegregation plans in the public schools, assisting minority businesses under the Minority Business Development Programs, and monitoring and enforcing the Fair Housing Act. I don't know, what's going to happen in the election, but it appears likely that we're going to be confronted with, a third term of the Obama administration. If we keep control of at least one of the houses of Congress, I think, as Mike says in the issue brief that he's written on this, we really need Congress to assert a role, not only on this particular matter that OMB has published on, but more generally on these divisive efforts involving race and ethnicity. I should note that Peter Kersenow, who has done Telefora for the Federalist Society recently, has submitted a comment to the to OMB on this, and I hope, as I said, that others will do so as well. Mike, we have the situation today where, unlike most Federalist Society events, we don't have the opposite side being presented here, which I'm perfectly comfortable with, since the opposite side is the embodiment of all that's evil and wrong with the world. But in the interest of fair time, what is the justification that OMB at least offers, for this proposal in the notice?
Well, I mean, it says that it wants data collection, and that's fair enough. I mean, I think it's important to have data. As you yourself has pointed out in the past, we don't collect data on religion, however, and it doesn't seem to our effort to make sure that religious minorities and different religious groups are not discriminated against has not suffered by the fact that the federal government does not collect data on religion. But let's say that we want to collect data. I think the blueprint for MENA, it really is Hispanic, which is a group that by itself tells you very little, because these are peoples with very different cultural indicators. Asians are also another group that have very different cultural indicators. And in fact, what I think California is trying to do at the present, although I don't want to comment on that because I haven't looked at it very closely, I think California is in the process of disaggregating the Asian ethnicity just to look at the indicators of each group. So bringing together people as disparate as Berbers and Persians and Arab Americans and Israelis really makes no sense. And a lot of this has a lot of internal inconsistencies. For example, Israelis will now be classified as MENA, which means that the grandson of a man born in Poland who lives in Israel, who was born in Israel but has since immigrated to the United States, will now be classified as a member of the MENA minority. But his first cousin, who was born in Brooklyn, will not be seen as a minority, will be considered white, and even though that he's his first cousin and everything is the same DNA-wise. So one thing is the data collection part. Now, another thing the notice says that it wants to do this because we are becoming a more diverse country. And that is the one that I pay some heed to the data collection, although I think doing it this way is the wrong way. But on this being a response to we becoming a more diverse country, I really disagree with that, because this is not the only response to being a more diverse country. We faced diversity many times in the past. During Ellis Island, as I said, many people came here from Syria and Lebanon and Armenia and Greece and Sicily and the East European Shuttle, and they were, if you've seen black and white pictures of New York at the time, it was a very diverse place, and we reacted in the opposite way. We had a very serious push to make sure that they all saw themselves as American, that they saw themselves that they became American, that there was a very strong Americanization process, rather than what we're seeing right now, which is dividing people into what Ward Carnelly called silly little boxes.
Well said. It's certainly true that, you can hypothesize situations where it's useful to have racial data. I mean, for instance, medical research, would be the sort of classic example. But there are also problems with data collection. You referred, I think, to this testimony that I gave years ago to the Civil Rights Commission, which is going to be posted may already be posted. I pointed out in that testimony that there are problems with data collection, too. There are the obvious ones of the government abusing the information, using it to advance racial preferences, using it to advance racially divisive programs, which, of course, the administration has announced is one reason why it's doing this. But there's also, I think a more insidious but no less serious problem, and that's the one, I think, Mike, that you're alluding to, which is that the very process of asking people, which silly little box do you put yourself into, is encouraging people to think of themselves and encouraging other people to think of them, not as principally Americans, but as something else, as black or as Asian or as Latino or now as, MENA. And that is a very high price to pay. It's, I think, part and parcel of really discouraging assimilation, discouraging people from thinking of themselves first and foremost as Americans.
It's a very high price, and we're really playing with very volatile forces here that we don't really understand. Now, in a previous life, I was a foreign correspondent. I lived in all over the world. One of the places I lived in was Belgium. I lived there close to 6 years for the Wall Street Journal. And I could tell you that Belgium is a lovely country with many assets, but one of them is not the division of the country into groups. The Walloons and the Flemish do not really have a what we can call appreciation for each other, to put it mildly. And that is all, created and fomented by this division of the country into groups. Now, I've come across a great quote from Helen Thomas, by the way, herself an Arab American. I don't know if people remember Helen Thomas. She was a White House correspondent for many decades. She was not a conservative by any means. I was her intern, by the way, in the 80s at the White House, and she treated me very well, even though she knew I was a conservative. But she once herself remarked, quote, "I think everybody who was born here or becomes a naturalized citizen is an American, period. You shouldn't have to put a hyphen between your nationality and your ethnic background," unquote. And she always talked about her parents in Detroit raised her to be an American, not to consider herself as a minority. And I think that Helen Thomas, who conservatives would not agree with on everything, would probably agree on her position here.
That's right. And these particular classifications, I think, not only do they have these high costs, but I think that the possible benefits that they could have are quite negligible. I mean, for example, you can't use this kind of classification for any kind of medical research because, as you pointed out, the groups are too heterogeneous. You can have all kinds of different people can check the, the MENA box or the Latino box. It tells you nothing about their physiology. And they're also very heterogeneous in terms of their socioeconomic status. So, it might have been useful to have information about African Americans as a way of tracking progress, after the end of the Jim Crow era and so forth. But, Asian Americans come from all over the world, actually, and have very different backgrounds. And, you alluded to the fact that in California they're now trying to disaggregate Asian Americans, and that's precisely because different Asian American groups have very different socioeconomic stories to tell. And, the left is unhappy with the fact that, for example, many Asian Americans don't like racial preferences because they perceive correctly that those preferences are being used to discriminate against them. And they hope that by disaggregating, that is, the left hopes that by disaggregating these groups, they can find subcategories of Asian Americans that they can promise to give, to have racial discrimination in favor of. So anyway, it's a very ugly game. Well,
Just to comment briefly, I always separate. I think the Voting Rights Act was a very good thing to have for African Americans, as you know, and people here on this call know. Many states like Alabama, Mississippi were playing awful games and the Voting Rights Act was the right remedy for the situation. I think the way it is being interpreted right now, especially with regards to these other ethnic groups and will be reinterpreted for MENA, is just playing games, and it's not doing anybody any good.
Very good. Well, Mike, I think between the two of us, we've been provocative enough, I hope, to get some folks to call in. Nate, do you have anybody in the queue?
Before I can do that, let me open up the floor for their call so they can get in line. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound sign on your phone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions, of course, in the order in which they are received. Again, if you want to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Okay, gentlemen, looks like we have two callers already. Let's go to the first question. Go ahead, caller.
Hello? Can you hear me? Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. I am a law school graduate, and I have written actually a paper on this very subject when it pertained to the to education law, specifically the Individuals with Disabilities Act, which, of course, is also uses ethnic and racial data in its reporting for now the ESSA, which is the Education Success Act, School Success Act. My question to you is that how will this racial change affect education policy? And a secondary question to that is that how is the interpretation of, let's say, how would people react to the new forms categories based on their actual knowledge of their own specific ethnicity through testing through, let's say, 23andMe, which a lot more people are doing now, which might also influence how people self-report.
Let me take number two first, and maybe Roger can jump on number one.
Okay.
I'm looking right now at one of the proposed boxes on how to redesign boxes you get in the Census Bureau, and it says one would say it says the first box is white, and then it has subcategories for German, Italian, Irish, Polish, English, French. The second box is Hispanic, Latino, or Spanish, and it has subcategories for Mexican, Salvadoran, Puerto Rican, Dominican, Cuban, and Colombian. I think what has happened in the past, as I said, if you study immigrants, if you have somebody who is whose mother was Salvadoran and whose father was, you know, a typical Heinz 57, quote-unquote, white American, that person would either would generally probably take white at some point, or his children would take white. What will happen now, what I think what the census wants to encourage you to do is to take both white and Hispanic, not that you're a white Hispanic, which is what we have right now, but that you're part white, part German, right, and part Cuban. And that, I think, will be seen then as a further category, and will encourage this majority-minority mindset that I think is behind all of this. Now, it's interesting that you raised 23andMe, because it was an ad, not for 23andMe, but for Ancestry.com, that actually got my attention last week. It began to air last week, and this refers to one of the things Roger said about how people begin to identify themselves as a member of one of these groups. And it's a woman speaking, and now you might recognize it. And she said, "When I travel abroad all the time, and when people ask me what my nationality is, I always said Hispanic, but I had myself tested in Ancestry.com, and here's what I found out." Now, that actually, and I look at this a lot, it's the first time that I've seen anybody in public or used in an ad say that their nationality is one of these groups. And that, I think, is what we're encouraging to people. Her nationality is not Hispanic. Her nationality is American. She may want to think of herself as Hispanic, which is a group created by the bureaucrats in the 70s, but that's not her nationality, and she owes allegiance to the United States and is an American. So I think that this is the kind of thinking that it encourages. So I hope I've answered question two. And Roger, would you like to take a crack at question one on the Education Service Act, Success
Sure.
Act?
Sure. You know, I think that, you know, one thing that we don't know is exactly what use all the different federal agencies and sub-agencies are going to use this information for. And I think that the answer may vary from agency to agency and from program to program. And for instance, in the education area, one of the programs that's specifically listed in the notice is that they're going to use this in school desegregation cases. Well, that strikes me as a little bit odd, you know, to be using, you know, the Middle Eastern, North American, North African category in desegregation cases. I mean, I'm not aware that there's been much, you know, segregation in public schooling, you know, along those lines. I mean, I suppose it's possible that, you know, somebody could say that in Detroit or someplace where there was a large enough population that there was, you know, some school district gerrymandering. But it seems dubious to me, and certainly dubious that you would that kind of, you know, limited problem, if there is a problem, would justify, you know, this kind of, you know, widespread collection of data with all the problems that it has. Likewise, unless you thought that there was some systematic problem with people of Middle Eastern and North African backgrounds being, you know, misclassified in terms of their disabilities, you know, in education, it seems hard to imagine that this would be of a great deal of use there either. However, if you have a liberal administration, you know, they are going to be aggressive in using these classifications, even if there really is no particular justification for them, because of the other bad, I think, you know, side effects that they have in encouraging identity politics.
Now, that just reminded me of something when Roger spoke about whether people of Arab descent have experienced discrimination in Detroit or Toledo or Massachusetts, where they settled in large numbers. Look, every group, if you read the history of this, every group in America that has come in has experienced exclusion and segregation and so forth. The Scots-Irish, you don't get more American than Scots-Irish, right? Then when they began to come in the early 1700s, they were really discriminated against. Boston passed a law that said they have to move off. And when they did move off and went to Worcester, a Puritan mob burned their church down. And there was another mob, I believe in 1727, that congregated in Boston Harbor to prevent a ships coming in from Belfast, bringing in more Scots-Irish. And when they went to Pennsylvania, they created problems there too. And in Richmond, they were told, you cannot practice your Presbyterianism here, or you can practice it in the mountains if you want to. So they moved off to Appalachia. What Nathan Glazer said is that each group has had a great phrase, I'm going to paraphrase here, has experienced all these problems, and they tried really, really hard to prove themselves better than the last group, and the country benefited as a result. But the federal government never felt that it had to come in and apportion participation in society for different groups, even though everybody faced exclusion and hard work and so forth. And that is what is at stake here, the federal government coming in and playing a very large role in apportioning participation in society. And that's what I'm against.
I would also add, Mike, that in the area of desegregation, this is another area where, you know, generally, you know, the liberal cures have turned out to be worse than the disease. I mean, even if it were shown that frequently school district lines were, you know, were gerrymandered in a particular way. The use of these statistics by a liberal administration would be to, you know, require, you know, busing or race-based student assignments in order to achieve a particularly, you know, politically correct racial and ethnic mix, which I think is no better than the kind of gerrymandering that it's supposed to cure. You know, there's plenty of laws on the books that would make racial classifications in school assignments illegal anyway, and you don't need this kind of mammoth data collection in order to fight it.
Okay, gentlemen, we have one caller waiting to ask a question presently. Just a reminder to the audience, if you want to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. I would like to make one programming note, that an announcement that our next Teleforum conference call will be Thursday, October 27th at 3 p.m. That call will discuss Chevron deference in the circuit courts, and it will feature Professor Kent Barnett from the University of Georgia School of Law, Professor Christopher Walker from the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, and it will be moderated by Stephen Vaden from Jones Day. And let's see, I think actually we may have lost that caller who was waiting. Let's see if we can pick them up. Oh, yes,
let me mention while we're waiting that if people are interested in commenting on this, I think that the best way to do it is to, or one way to do it, Mike, maybe you have a better idea, but if you go to Mike's issue brief that he's written for the Heritage Foundation, the first footnote there links to the regulation. And I'm looking at it now, and you know, you can click onto the regulation and submit a comment that way. And the name of Mike's issue brief is Congress Should Tell the OMB to Stop Dividing the Country. So, you know, if you Google Mike Gonzalez and Congress and OMB, I think you'll find it pretty quickly.
And also, you can see other people's comments as well.
Very good. We have a caller ready. Let's go to that call now.
Hello, Roger and Mike. This is Roger Severino from the Heritage Foundation. So when I was at DOJ Civil Rights, I enforced the Fair Housing Act, and we had a case that dealt with discrimination against people of Middle Eastern descent and South Asian descent. And we didn't have that much trouble figuring out how to find folks like that, using last name analysis and things of the sort. And it struck me that the OMB note mentioned that this would be used to enforce the Fair Housing Act. And I believe it's referring to being able to use the census data for disparate impact analysis. Now, with the inclusive communities decision from the Supreme Court recently, the FHA can use, it's being interpreted to apply a disparate impact frame, which of course is all about statistics and categorization based on census data. So I wonder if you've given any thought, maybe Roger or Mike, on the disparate impact side of the equation.
Well, I think that, as I noted earlier, the administration has been very aggressive in its use of the disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement, and that includes the Fair Housing Act, it includes employment, it includes voting, it includes credit, it includes, you know, just about any civil rights law it can find. It likes to use the disparate impact approach, and of course it's very important when you bring a disparate impact, in fact it's essential, you know, when you're bringing a disparate impact case to have a statistical base from which you can work. So yeah, I think that is part of what's at work here. As I noted, I think that the left likes this kind of racial categorization, not only for its own sake, you know, for the identity politics and so forth that it encourages, but also as a tool for other items on its agenda, like the use of racial preferences and like bringing, you know, disparate impact lawsuits. There are a lot of problems with the disparate impact approach in every area that it's been used, and that includes housing. So it's too bad that the Supreme Court has blessed it, but the administration is using it. In fact, just in last week, they warned landlords that they needed to be very careful about screening applicants for their criminal histories, because that kind of screening can have a disparate impact on the basis of race.
And by the way, I think in that case you're referring to, they were using the same methodology that the EEOC itself uses to screen out people. Now, disparate impact is the gift that keeps on giving. And because once you have, you can show statistically that one group is affected more than another, you don't have to prove any intent or anything at all. You can just so it's a license for mischief making, and I think any further data that is collected will be used to add to this license for mischief that is the disparate impact.
Roger, did you have any other follow-up question on that? You're still.
No, you've been great. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, gentlemen, let's go. We have one caller waiting in the queue. Let's go to him or her now.
Hi, Gene Meyer. A question. I've missed a part of this, so you might have covered it, but I don't think so. Say hypothetically the Hispanics who are qualified as white have a significantly different set of views than those who aren't. If you group those as Hispanic rather than as white, it has some of the effects you're talking about, but it also has the effect of making Hispanics as a group having a different set of views than they would without that group in there. And isn't it, you know, sort of whatever your perspective is, you gain on one hand and lose on the other. Does it come out about even, or you clearly think it doesn't come out about even?
Let me see if I've understood your question correctly, Gene. I think it does have an impact on people who begin to see themselves. I think people do begin to see themselves as Hispanic or Latino. And in fact, when I was writing a book on the subject, which I published 2 years ago, called The Race for the Future, I remember I interviewed somebody who's a famous person, so I don't want to say her name, but she said her name. She said she was Latina, and I, you know, talked to her, and she found, you know, both her parents were from El Salvador, and she actually felt Salvadoran. So I said, "Well, why did you say you were Latina?" And she looked at me and smiled and said, "Because I think that's what I'm supposed to say." And I think that over time, people, the social scientists who look at this, say that there is a chance that they will. People will be, when you're told constantly by the government, by schools, and I think Alejandro Portes and Ruben Rumbau, two liberal academics, have done wonderful work on this, and they looked at quote-unquote Hispanic students, and before high school they identify themselves as American, and then after 4 years of high school they identify themselves, a great number of them, as Hispanic. So there is the beginning of that now. I think what OMB and the administration, the White House actually, is trying to do here, it makes sure that it continues to head in that direction and it doesn't go in the other direction. Because if you see yourself as white, whether you're born of two Hispanic parents or not, or because you're born of a Salvadoran father and an Irish mother, I think that it has a reinforcing mechanism. As I said, I think that you begin to not want to change things. You see America as your own, and I think that goes against the grain of the agenda here. I mentioned the Scots-Irish before. If you look at a map of counties of the United States, what people identify themselves as, what you see through Appalachia, the people who identify themselves as American are the Scots-Irish. That great swath in Appalachia that goes from northern Alabama all the way to middle Pennsylvania, but everybody else sees themselves as something as ethnically something else. I don't know if I answered your question correctly. If I didn't, you want to come back and ask it again? I can try to. Roger, you want to say anything or?
Yeah, let me just make one. And that, I agree with everything that you said, Mike. And there are all kinds of problems with this approach. Another one, particularly in the area involving Hispanics, who think of themselves or who categorize themselves as whites, it can confound the data collection in another way too. Because if as groups become more assimilated, they become more likely to identify as something other than Hispanic, and of course it can be because of intermarriage or all kinds of things. Then those Hispanics are going to look differently, socioeconomically, than Hispanics who maybe have just arrived and do have this, are more likely to self-identify as Hispanic. But of course, if you do, what that means is that you're going to make generalizations that may not be accurate. You may say that, Hispanics are generally poor, or Hispanics are generally not going to college. Well, that's only because the people who identify principally as Hispanic are less likely to be doing well economically or less likely to be going to college because they just can't come here. But once they've been here a generation or two, they're doing well economically. They have English as their only language. They're more likely to go to school, but they don't identify as Hispanic anymore. So you get this, you reach the wrong conclusion that Hispanics are not doing very well in the United States. I think that a useful thought experiment is the United States, particularly the left, at the left's encouragement, has become race obsessed. We think about race way too much, particularly on campuses, but in other areas as well. And I think it's useful to engage in a thought experiment where we thought, what would happen if, what kind of a country would this be if people were really not encouraged to think of themselves as much as members of this or that racial or ethnic group. And I think when you begin to envision a country like that, it's a much happier, more amicable country. And finally,
by the way, I just wanted to say that a bias that Roger just described has already been identified in the science, in the social science. I believe it was Stephen Trejo who's written about this, and he used the example you used, Roger, with Mexican Americans, the ones who become more assimilated or go to university have a tendency not to identify themselves as Mexican American anymore, and thus the data on success is biased, and you see the opposite effect with, I believe he said, Haitians, where kids or descendants of Haitian immigrants who do very well at school will over-identify themselves as Haitian, whereas the ones who perform less well will over-identify themselves as African-American. So when you look at data on Haitian-Americans, they do really, really, really well, and in fact that overstates how well they do.
This really is, Mike, a great country. This is such a great country that, even the president of the Federalist Society, when he phones in to a teleforum, he stands in line with everybody else. He may not be the first person in the queue, but he's okay with that. And I think that encapsulates what's great about this country.
Could I ask one brief follow-up on this?
Certainly.
Yeah.
I'm the last part of what was said is exactly kind of what I'm wondering about. In other words, I don't know. It's just sort of as a thought experiment. But to the extent, let's assume the economics are very strong in this regard. What effect does it have if the view is, well, most Hispanics are poor and not doing as well, as opposed to if the view is of most Hispanics is much more mixed? And clearly, if you, according to what you're saying, hypothetically at least, if you count, if the Hispanics who have been counting themselves as white were counted as Hispanics, it would be a much more mixed picture. I think you make a strong point about some other effects that might exist from that. But I'm just wondering how much this might be a mixed bag.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that if you have Hispanics who are identified as white now identifying as Hispanics who are doing quite well, then Hispanics overall won't be seen as doing as poorly, which might or might not be helpful. I'm just throwing it out as a question. I don't know.
I see
your point. I don't see why we want to force people, pin people into these groups. I think that, when you come in as an immigrant, and some Hispanics have been here since the 1700s, but a very small minority, but others have come in, a third generation, or people like me, a first generation, you don't really need to be handed another label. When I came in as a kid, I was Cuban on my way to being American, and I really didn't need to be handed a halfway house to be in or an ethnic classification. I never heard of Hispanic until a cousin, an uncle in Queens, New York, in the early 70s, told me about it, and I thought it was fascinating. Wow, interesting. My first question was, is that because Grandpa was born in Spain? And so you see, there's really no need for this in the first place, I don't think. If you want to collect data by nation of origin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point, Mike. And Gene, you're correct that there are good uses to which data can be put, and this is actually something that I've talked with Abigail Thernstrom about. Social scientists. Abby made the point to me that, I know that Ward Connerly wants to get rid of these silly little boxes, but actually having this data is very useful in dispelling some of the paranoia on the left. The left will say, there's been no progress made since the Jim Crow era. And Abby made the point that, that's not true. And thank goodness that we have this data that we can use to put the lie to that notion. So it's not that you can't ever, think of situations where the data might be useful. But, there are some caveats. First of all, as we've talked about, you've got to weigh the costs of the data collection, not only the costs of, forcing people to think of themselves as a particular way and encouraging other people to think of them as a particular way, but also the abuses to which the government, puts this information. But then there's also the problem that frequently, this information is of limited utility because of the way the government goes about collecting it. And that's the point that Mike made, that, if these boxes are basically sort of, very dubious in how accurate they show anything, then whatever use they might have becomes greatly attenuated. And you're better off, as Mike says, collecting information about particular national origins than you are lumping them all together into politically correct categories like Hispanics or Latinos or Asians or now Middle Eastern North Africans that really are too heterogeneous to tell you anything. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good.
Gene, well, we're honored to have your participation, Gene. We appreciate you calling in, and I don't know if you were on the first part of the call, but I really appreciate the fact that the Federalist Society has put this particular teleform together so quickly because it is so timely. The Obama administration did not allow very much time for comment on this particular proposal, and it was important that we get this teleforum up soon because comments are due, you know, within a week.
It's the advantage of not being a bureaucracy.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Gene. Thanks to the Federalist Society as well.
Okay, very good, gentlemen. We do have one other caller waiting. I think we can go to that call now.
Hi, I was a previous caller, and I have a follow-up question concerning the history. Specifically, I know Mike had mentioned about historical data through the colonial times. I have been reading in my own research several articles written in the LA Times, specifically by a lawyer who did his own genetic testing. And I'm curious as to what box he should now click in his census, because he's a descendant of Hispanic immigrants who were originally Spanish Jews who were part of the migration of Spanish Jews after the Inquisition to Central America, who eventually his family immigrated to America and settled in California. So what box now should his family click?
Exactly, and that's the thing. I mean, 23andMe and Ancestry.com, through science, is showing how crazy this whole thing is. I haven't had those tests done, but my sister has, and it's the same thing. You know, everybody who is of Spanish origin is going to have a lot of Jewish, Arab, in my case, or my sister's case, a lot of Irish, I guess because of northwestern Spain. So everybody is the end product. It's not easily classifiable. This is why if you want to collect health data, but please collect it from me and do not extrapolate from the Hispanic group about me, because I want to make sure that I am well.
Thank you very much. And I agree, this has been a very timely and interesting call.
Thank you.
You're
welcome.
Okay, gentlemen, we are running a little short on time. Are there any concluding remarks you'd like to leave us with?
I'll go first very briefly. This really deserves a lot more attention than it is given. It really is the demographic games that the other side is playing, and we need to pay close attention to this. Roger?
I agree. And, you know, it's very disturbing when you look at the larger context of this. You know, I came to the Center for Equal Opportunity, you know, almost 20 years ago, and I really felt like that, or I hoped that, you know, we were at the point in this country where it was not going to be too long before we, you know, we got rid of racial and ethnic preferences, where we got rid of this whole race-driven approach to public policy. You know, I continue to be optimistic that this country will continue its dramatic progress, you know, in race relations and toward our founding ideal of a pluribus unum. But, you know, increasingly, I can maintain that optimism only by stepping back and taking a longer view of the country's history, and not by focusing on where we are right now, because I think that
our elites in academia and our political elites, particularly, in this administration, don't want that kind of progress. They have bought in to, this diversity, in quotes, mindset that really encourages the division of individuals and individuals identifying as something other than American first, and it's very disturbing.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Just a reminder to our audience to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Mike Gonzalez from the Heritage Foundation and Roger Clegg from the Center for Equal Opportunity for joining us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.